Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Sometimes the weekend just sneaks up on you, you know? Our Friday weekly wrap coming up on the broadcast today. Also, how to boil water and a new way to work at home. And those are different stories, by the way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 12th of September. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. And I know, what better way to end a week, you are saying to yourself right now, than to spend 4 or 5 minutes wrapping up what happened in business and economics the 5 days gone by. Well, all right. If that's what you really want to do, we will do it. Good thing we've got Felix Salmon from Fusion and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine standing by to help us out. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Okay.
All right. Let us start, Lee, with the stock market, the looming initial public offering of Alibaba, the Chinese conglomerate. People have called it the Amazon thereof. It's going to be the biggest IPO, the biggest stock offering ever. My question to you is, what's all the hubbub, bub?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I guess...
All right, there you go.
Jack Ma, they were in town this week in New York and at the Waldorf Big Lunch. And I didn't see traffic stop the way it is when the president's here, but you almost would expect it given the hype that's been that there is around Alibaba. And it's really three words. It's China, internet commerce, I guess, and China and the China consumer. And that's what it is. This is the key to unlocking the explosive growth of the Chinese consumer. I mean, you know, it's not a glamorous technology. It's not that newfangled. It's no Google or even Uber. It is a trading platform.
Felix, we should all run screaming from this thing then, right?
Why? Because it works?
Well, because everybody's piling in, and there were 800 investment backers lined up. I mean, come on.
Six investment banks, biggest IPO in the world. I honestly think this is a shopping utility in China, and if Chinese people are going to go shopping more in the future than they do right now, which is almost certain, and if they live on their phones, which they do, I can't see how Alibaba isn't absolutely worth what they're pricing it at.
Which is a lot of money. I mean, it's going to be...
The risk, of course, is the capital markets risk. You're buying shares in New York, which are of a holding company, which, you know, you don't quite know whether you could just lose control of the company. The company itself is a very valuable company. The question is, how much actual real ownership do you have if you buy these shares?
Yeah, but Lee, don't we sort of have a history in this country in the not-so-distant past of going bananas over these IPOs and then it not working out?
We have a history of going bananas over everything. I mean, yes. And, you know, I mean, I agree with Felix. And maybe I'm just – I have this sort of knee-jerk reaction against hype. This is probably why I'm a journalist and not an investor. I mean, you know, there is a tremendous opportunity there. But the amount of profit that this company has to make to sustain the valuation that we're talking going forward is significant, as we've pointed out.
Speaking of hype, Felix, I will turn very quickly and briefly to Apple, the watch, the phone. Yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. Anything more to be said other than it's interesting they keep innovating this way, huh?
I was a little bit disappointed in the phone, in the watch, and actually in the phone as well, because I like smaller phones, which I can use with one hand. And it seems like this is officially the end of small smartphones. We only have big and bigger anymore. And I think that's sad.
Lee, very quickly, can we now say that this is Tim Cook's Apple? I asked Ben Johnson, our tech guy, this very same question the day the phone came out. Is this now Tim Cook's Apple and not Steve Jobs' Apple anymore?
I think it is. And even though some people had said, you know, we're not as thrilled with this week, I do think it succeeded there. But I will say, I think Felix and I are completely disagreeing this week because I want my phone to only get bigger. I want my iPad to get smaller and I want my phone to get bigger. And I think that is the magic size. And I'm very excited about that.
And the twain is meeting here, I guess. All right. All right. Let's move on. Felix, Scotland. There is the referendum in 6 days' time whether the Scottish should become independent. You are on the record on Twitter, as am I in point of fact, for thinking that this yes vote is going to succeed. Do you still believe that in light of the recent polling and the fact that the banks have said, yeah, we're leaving Scotland if this happens?
I think the Scots will say good riddance to the banks, quite frankly. They saw what the banks did in 2007, 2008, and they don't want to see that again. I still believe that you and I are right. It's going to be a real nail biter. It's going to be very, very close. But the Scots are sick of being run by these English who they don't like and who don't agree with them on anything.
Lee, just lay it on the line.
I'm going to disagree again. I don't think it's going to happen. And not just because to keep it a trend, to keep it a hat trick of disagreeing.
I was just going to say, it is the contrarian rap today. Felix Salmon from Fusion, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thanks,
Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. Wall Street today, well, it could have been better, I suppose. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In his big speech Wednesday night, President Obama talked a whole lot about his military strategy for dealing with ISIS, not so much about how to take them on economically. ISIS has found ways to make money that more conventional economic sanctions might not be all that effective against. So, what to do about that? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
Money gushes into ISIS from lots of places. International donors, ISIS extorts money from people in places it controls, and it gets lots of cash from black market oil sales. ISIS gets the oil from fields it captured in Iraq and Syria. So you could just go after that territory, according to Robin Mills with Manar Energy in Dubai.
And we've seen in Iraq a number of oil fields that are actually recaptured by the Iraqi army or by Kurdish forces. And that's obviously the most direct way of preventing ISIS obtaining oil and selling oil.
Otherwise, your chances of closing the ISIS oil spigot are pretty limited. Mills says after it's pumped, it's trucked to Turkey, where it melts away into a vast black oil market. What about finding ISIS's rich donors and hitting them with penalties and sanctions? Adam Slater is a senior economist at Oxford Economics. He says the ISIS benefactors are very hard to find.
I think it's much more unclear who these people are, how they operate, where any assets they have might be.
And here's another thing. ISIS is frugal. It doesn't need much money to function. Ben Connable is an international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation.
They're not buying equipment, they're seizing equipment. They're not hiring people at high salaries, they're purposefully hiring people at relatively low salaries.
So even if the U.S. did have lots of ways of cutting off the money, Connable says ISIS could still survive for a long time. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You may not know the name Darden Restaurants, but they helped put the casual dining business on the map with family-friendly chains like Olive Garden and, until they sold it this past summer, Red Lobster as well. A slow consumer economy, though, and competition from chains like Chipotle has taken some of the zip out of Darden. So enter now a hedge fund that is fighting for control of Darden's board and has offered nearly 300 pages worth of suggestions for reviving things, right down to the way Olive Garden boils its water. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
For a taste of Starboard Value's recipe for fixing Darden restaurants, check out slide number 164, Add Salt. The hedge fund says Olive Garden stopped salting its pasta water to get a longer warranty on its pots, calling the decision appalling.
Absolutely. It's very important because otherwise, if you don't salt the water, the pasta that you cook in it won't have any flavor in it.
That's not an investor. It's Italian cookbook author and teacher Giuliano Hazan. Starboard has other problems with the food. Authentic Italian dishes like tortellini Fasano have been replaced by the likes of fried lasagna bites. The legendary endless breadsticks have lost their taste, and they're flowing a little too freely. Ron Ruggles is Southwest Bureau Chief for Nation's Restaurant News.
Bread, of course, is cheap if you look at it individually. But if you multiply it by the 840 Olive Garden locations, that's a lot of dough.
Starboard has some meatier suggestions, like spinning off real estate into a separate company and expanding internationally. In a statement, Darden says it remains open-minded to new ideas. Shareholders will vote next month on which side will control the board. But restaurant analyst Robert Darrington with Wunderlich Securities says the company's biggest problem isn't going away.
Regardless of who wins the battle, there's essentially too many restaurant choices for consumers, and when they're tight with their spending, they'll spend where they can afford to dine.
According to market research firm NPD Group, visits to casual dining restaurants have dropped by more than half a billion annually in the last 5 years. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And now a little slice of life from Washington, D.C., from the U.S. Senate, to be just a little bit more specific. Senators, as I'm sure you have heard, rarely pass up an opportunity to promote their home states. Which team has won which championship, what businesses are based there, what products are made there, you get the idea. You want to know where this skill is really on display, though? A spot right in the back of the Senate chamber known as the Candy Desk. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
The candy desk has been around for almost half a century. Don Ritchie, the Senate historian, traces it back to 1965, to Senator George Murphy.
He was an old song and dance man. He danced with Shirley Temple in the movies.
We should be together, like the frame and picture,
like shoes and stockings.
He also had a sweet tooth, Ritchie says.
Senator Murphy filled his desk drawer with candies, which he dipped into.
You're a cup of coffee.
Oh, you're a peachy pie.
And then he invited his colleagues to stop whenever they wanted to.
Murphy lost his seat in 1970, but the tradition continued.
You have a chance to sell your state's products there or talk about stuff.
The desk, which is right by the main door to the Senate chamber, currently belongs to Illinois Senator Mark Kirk. As a result, it's chock full of candies manufactured in the land of Lincoln. For Kirk, a fan of Chicago's Ferrara Candy Company, it's personal.
They offered me all of the desks on the Republican side, and I wanted to make sure that those bastards in Hershey, Pennsylvania, couldn't get the candy desk.
Kirk is referring, of course, to the Hershey Company, which had a monopoly on senators' suites for years. The desk used to belong to Rick Santorum, and the former senator from Pennsylvania filled it with Kit Kats and Kisses. The desk has suited some senators better than others.
My name is George Voinovich, and I'm a retired U.S. senator.
Voinovich represented Ohio, a state not known for its confections, so his tenure at the candy desk did not last long.
I think it was only a year. That was enough.
I used to joke that it was an unfunded mandate that I had to provide candy for the rest of my senators.
George Lemieux was a senator from Florida.
But I was happy to do so.
Mark Kirk, the man currently charged with filling the candy desk's drawers, likes Jelly Belly brand jelly beans, and there are plenty of those in the candy desk. But Kirk also stocks it with baby aspirin. He had a stroke in 2012, and a small daily dose of the painkiller, he tells his colleagues and constituents, can prevent strokes and heart attacks. And while this means there's less room for Illinois candy, Kirk is able to draw attention to another constituent. The company that makes the aspirin is based just outside of Chicago. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
David's story is part of our collaboration with Mental Floss magazine. Their piece about Senator Sweet Tooth is in their September issue. Coming up, there is working from home, and then there is working from somebody else's home.
You're taking a residential setting, and all of a sudden, you're making it a workplace.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 61 points today, about a third percent, closed at 16,987. The NASDAQ off 24 points, about a half percent, 4567. 4567, how about that? The S&P 500 shed 11.6 tenths percent, and it things at 1985. What can I tell you? I just noticed. A down day and a down week. The Dow off 9 tenths percent. The NASDAQ off 3 tenths percent. The S&P 500 ended the week 1.1% lower. New sanctions against Russia from the U.S. and the EU are aimed at oil exploration and energy stocks. Got pinched today. ExxonMobil down 1.25%. Chevron off nearly 1% on the day. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its monthly report on industrial production for August. 6 years ago, on September 15, 2008, Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. And in Cambridge, Massachusetts, members of the punk band Pussy Riot participate in an event hosted by Harvard Kennedy School. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The cable network A&E is making some programming changes. It's dropping a show called Longmire. It's about a sheriff out in Wyoming, and it is, as it happens, the second most popular show on that network. Why, then, is it being canceled? Well, because the median age of the Longmire audience is 60, and advertisers weren't so interested, it seems, in that particular demographic. It is received wisdom in advertising that younger consumers are more valuable than older ones are, but Marketplace's Queenie Kim says that is just an outdated notion.
There's lots of reasons advertisers love young consumers. One of them, they're young, and that means they love trying and buying new things, unlike old consumers.
I think that there are a few myths when we talk about older people.
Erin Reed is with the marketing firm Creating Results.
Older adults are stuck in their ways. They're not going to try new brands. So why should I even bother advertising to them, right? Well, my grandmother would say, pshaw.
Reed says that might have been true like 50 years ago, but boomers are breaking those stereotypes and shaking up their lives in ways that previous generations didn't.
They're moving houses. Their kids are leaving home. Divorce.
And she says all those changes are opportunities to try new brands and experiences. There's also the fact that people are living longer and more active lives. Cassie McGillner is a professor at Wharton, and she says in part this is affecting consumer behavior.
Amongst older people who feel like they have a lot of time left, they're actually behaving very much like young people. They're looking for excitement as opposed to calming things.
And like young people, they're willing to buy new products and experiences that bring that excitement. Kurt Medina is a marketing consultant, and he says there is one big difference between young and old.
50-plussers account for something like 75% of all disposable income in the United States.
Medina says that by sidestepping TV shows like Longmire, advertisers are missing out on the money pot. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
We took you out to Allentown, Pennsylvania yesterday for the series we do with Jim Fallows called American Futures. We were looking at how that city is trying to rebuild its economically damaged downtown by using some pretty hefty tax incentives. There's $1 billion in development either underway or in the planning process in Allentown, including, as a centerpiece, a spiffy new arena. There's a big concert set for tonight in that arena. The Eagles are in town, and when we were there, it did not look like there was a chance the thing was going to be done, but it turns out I was wrong. Jim Fallows is out on the road again, and we have tracked him down and gotten him on the line. Jim, it's good to talk to you once more.
Thank you, Kai. Nice to talk to you.
I will tell you, we heard from Lee Butz overnight, the guy we talked about at the ballpark back a couple of weeks ago when we were there. He says the arena is done. What do your people in Allentown say?
I talked to the mayor, Ed Pawlowski, this morning. He said it's done. I talked to Doug Pelletier, a big entrepreneur there. He said it was done 2 days ago. So Neither you nor I thought this was possible, but they say they're ready to go for the Eagles tonight.
It's kind of a pity we didn't put some money on that one, I think. I don't know. Do me a favor and give me your sense of how Allentown fits into the Fallows Unified Field theory of American futures. You know, these towns doing it sort of despite dysfunction on the national level on so many ways.
But what's so interesting is that you see the end result in some cities that have really revived themselves economically. I'd use Greenville, South Carolina as an example, where they have a downtown where people shop and they dine and they live and they work. And you can see how it all looks, and people look back and say, you know, 15 years ago, you'd be afraid to walk down the street. Allentown is right at the beginning of that process. And as you heard and described last night on the show, they're trying to force feed it in just a couple of years through these very important tax incentives and through other efforts to try to make it happen all at once. So if they can do that, you know, the result, they all know what it's supposed to look like, and I guess we're just going to have to watch to see if they get there.
The thing is, though, and we talked about this briefly while we were there, you know, that the arena that's going up on the corner of 7th and Hamilton and the $1 billion that's being spent is great, but four blocks away, there are large immigrant communities, there are working class people who are not yet seeing any of what's happening in that investment zone.
It's true. And I think that as we discussed at the time, it's a better class of problem to have than the reverse.
Right.
If the class of problem is how they're going to share the improvements, if they happen, that's a better problem than just having to continue to cut back every place else. So I think the bet that the mayor and the state senator and their developers and everybody else are making is that they will be able to lift the whole city, and we'll see.
Do you think this model works in other places, in other cities of similar sizes with similar problems?
It's an extreme version. I mean, that sounds pejorative. It's an unusually pure version of what we've seen in other places that takes a longer time. And again, at the end of the cycle, you can say, oh, yes, we see how each little domino led to the next. People work downtown, then they wanted to eat downtown, then they decide to live downtown. And so in a large sense, it's similar to what's worked elsewhere. I don't know whether there's any place else that can get the same kind of concentrated tax incentive,
right,
and had so much space that could be developed all in one place.
James Fallows is, of course, the national correspondent for The Atlantic. Our series with him and his wife, Deb, is called American Futures. There is more on our website. It's marketplace.org and at The Atlantic, where you can read all of Jim's adventures. Jim, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Kai.
Much as the nature of work in this economy is changing, so too is the nature of where we work. 25 million Americans now work from home at least once a month, and there is an increasing dependence on part-timers and contractors, some of whom don't go to an office at all. There is, yes, always the local Starbucks, but there is also room for a little bit of creative thinking in this space. Here's Sally Herships.
It's 10 in the morning, and I'm rushing to tidy up because people are coming over. Found one doggy toy. These aren't typical guests. They're coworkers who are going to work at my dining room table for the day. We're beta testing a new startup called Spare Chair. It's a website that lets you rent out space in your home, like Airbnb, but for workers. So the three of us are strangers. We've never met. So tell me what you both do.
I'm a producer and comedian.
I'm a web developer, I guess.
Jerry, Amica, and Nate Graves are both 32 and both live in Brooklyn. Spare Chair lets homeowners or renters like me set their own rental rates, and the site takes a cut. I asked Amica how he feels about paying to work at someone's dining room table.
I don't think it's that strange. I mean, it's 2014. We're already dating online. We're sharing our homes for strangers to live in, and we pay a lot of money to live at our homes. Why can't we, like, work at home?
My apartment is in Brooklyn, and I had some concerns.
It's crazy.
I also don't think it's that noisy, even though I can see you cringing.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to a coffee shop, this is steps above that.
In terms of noise, Graves says working from home made it too easy to get distracted, and coffee shops were too loud, so he usually uses a co-working space. Spare Chair would be about the same cost. Because I'm just testing the site, I didn't charge Graves or Emeka, but normal users would, which can be a big plus of co-working.
Cost reduction. It's the economics.
Ed Glickman teaches finance at NYU Stern School of Business. He says coworkers tend to be young and live in expensive cities like New York or Seattle. He says for the homeowner, coworking can literally pay off.
All of a sudden, not only do you have company, you have somebody who might give you connections, but you also have a way to help pay your rent.
And not just for the month. Glickman says co-working can lead to the formation of companies. People sharing space know what the others are up to and sometimes join forces by pitching projects together. But he says using a co-working space is different than renting desk space in a home.
You're taking a residential setting and all of a sudden you're making it a workplace and you're becoming a landlord.
Glickman says before renting space to workers, you may want to check with your own landlord and your insurance policy. Also, your boss. That's according to Douglas McCabe. He teaches management at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business. He says while some workers love telecommuting, managers can still be skeptical.
Are individuals working from home goofing off? Are they really working 8 hours a day?
McCabe says there are pros and cons to working from home. Potential pros: no commute and hiding from coworkers who want to talk sports while you're busy. He says a particular kind of worker can be even more productive at home, but he says most miss the camaraderie and can feel disengaged from the office, like when he was home after having a medical procedure.
I thought this was going to be a party, staying at home for 3 months, catching up on books that I've not read for a number of years. And I realized after about 6 weeks, boy, I miss the workplace. I want to go in every day to be with my colleagues.
Your default should be you need to be with the people that you work with.
Ben Weber is CEO of Sociometric Solutions. The company uses wearable technology to understand how people's interactions at work relate to their job performance and satisfaction.
I mean, listen, the whole reason we work in companies is because together we can do something that we couldn't do by ourselves.
Weber says, of course, it depends on the kind of work that you do. But for most, working solo is only okay sometimes. He says co-working is better than working alone, which is what we're experimenting with at my apartment today.
So you're packing up. So did you get all your work done?
I got as much done as I needed to.
I was worried, but so did I. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, which we'll do in the form of a quiz, just to shake things up. How about that? Who do you suppose drinks more coffee? Police officers or journalists? The easy answer is cops. I know it is also wrong. A study over in the UK has journalists edging out police officers and, interestingly, teachers at just over 4 cups a day. All right, with that, it is Friday indeed, and that is Marketplace. The Dow off 61 points today, more than a 3%. The NASDAQ down 24 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 dipped 11 points. That is 0.6%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.